today we're going to talk about foster care, and we're not going to spend the whole day talking about moms, although I do want to share. This is sort of how I feel on Mother's Day as a foster parent. Whoa, that's difficult to read. A child born to another woman calls me mommy. The magnitude of that tragedy and the depth of that privilege is not lost on me. That's how I feel. I feel it's an honor and a privilege, and it's also a tragedy that we are even having to talk about foster care in this room this morning, because I wish that families were resourced and brought up in ways where they could always stay with the kids that are born to them. And that's just not the case. It's just not the truth. And so we're excited to share some of our story this morning. And even if foster care is far from your radar this morning, we're just praying that God speaks to your heart about the things that matter to you, and that he'll continue to guide you in those ways. So
we were thinking over, like, how did we get here? Because people, I was telling someone yesterday, like, they're like, how did you decide to become like a foster parent? And I'm like, honestly, when it came time to say yes, it was like a no-brainer. And so it's like so many little steps led up to that. And so we were hoping to share a little bit about that. So we've traced it back at least to 2005, at least for me in my journey. I was in seminary at the time, and I had to take a certain number of Bible classes. And one of those classes was an Old Testament prophets class. And so it was like we read through all of the prophets in the Old Testament. And what really struck me in that class, though I was just going there because I was required to, it's one of the classes that sticks out to me, because I realized that there's this discrepancy between the Christian life that I was born into and discipled into, and the different churches, and what the Old Testament prophets, the message was saying. Because my professor said, basically every prophet talks about two things. That's the biggest thing. If you want to summarize the Old Testament prophets, it comes down to how to be faithful to God and how to take care of the poor, the widows, and the orphans. And so we read all of these verses, and it was, I mean, it's just like talking about caring for orphans is so prevalent in all the scriptures. But particularly the prophets are just like, this is what it means to be the people of God, is you take care of God's people. And so I just was recognizing that discrepancy between so often we just want to think more about God, and just being God's hands and feet in the world has been a consistent message. So I really had to face that discrepancy in my own self. And then in 2006, Christina and I, and we've shared a little bit about this, we started this hands and feet group / ministry / whatever you want to call it. And it was in the apartment complex that Christina and a lot of our friends were living at the time while they were going to school. I think the point that is relevant to this discussion is it was one of the first moments where I really had to grapple with my white privilege and how my life was so different and set on such a different path, and I had a solid family, and so many things in life were prepped for me to then be going to college 8 hours away from my where I grew up, and to be, you know, paying a private college and to be going to seminary. And so we couldn't name it at the time what that feeling was. There's like this difference between the people, the impoverished area we're living in, a lot of kids who only had single parents, who are living with other family members, who are latchkey kids. And we just saw this need, and we're like, what can we give? And so we were like, okay, well, the least we can do is just use some of our free time to hang out with these kids and to show them they matter, and we care about them. And so what this thing developed into is just like twice a week, we would just play games with kids. And we would throw pool parties because there's a pool at the apartment, and we threw a carnival, and we did all these things. We just shared our lives with the kids. And
we put a watermelon and rolled it in Crisco and then put it in the pool, which probably wasn't what they wanted us to do. But have you guys heard of this game and you try to like push it across? It's really difficult.
It is.
Because
it's so slippery and it's bobbing in the water. It's pretty awesome. It's like reverse tug of war, basically.
Yeah, it was bad.
It's like push the melon. That was it.
Okay.
For me, yeah.
So then I was also working at a daycare while I was going to school. I was going to same college, same seminary as Dustin, getting a double master's degree there. And I'm just surrounded by way different lifestyle of people at the daycare. So a lot of, I mean, everybody's working, right, because their kids are in daycare, and then lots of single parents who are dropping their kids off at the beginning of the day and then not seeing them, you know, 6 to 6, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And worked in a couple different rooms, but the room I was working with at the time was the elementary classroom. We had, like, up to 40 kids for that summer we were there, and in one small classroom. It was a terrible, terrible idea. And honestly, it was terrible most days. But there was one particular family. I remember when they walked in for the first time, the mom looked so tired. And lots of parents are tired, right? But there was a difference in her demeanor that was noticeable to me. She had three kids, and a boy, Christopher, was not 8 or 9 at the time, and then a girl, Haley, and then Summer, 6 and 5. Sweet little family. And right away, I noticed that the kids wore the same clothes all the time. A lot of times they hadn't, probably hadn't bathed. Mom was doing the best she could. I think she might have been working at nighttime too, leaving the kids with the with her boyfriend at the time. And anyway, they just became kind of our next thing to say yes to, these kids. There was one day particular where I believe mom couldn't get there after work, and so we took them home. I took them home, said, hey, I'm bringing home some kids, and which you were not supposed to do when you work at a daycare. There's a lot of reasons not to do that. We were in our 20s, and we were just making decisions based on our hearts, so whatever. So they came to our house, and they hung out with us. They did not stay the night that night, but they went back to their mom's, to their mom's house. But we did start inviting them to this Hands and Feet ministry that we had, so we'd see them a couple nights a week. We'd also take them to church with us. They were really sweet kids, a lot of behavior issues. But the thing that stuck out to me the most was one day I was leaving to go to work, and I had forgotten something, so I was going back, and I saw Christopher, 9 years old at this point, at the corner of our apartment complex, standing behind this bush and this sign. And I was like, I pulled over, and I was like, Chris, what are you doing? It was a school day, because they were back in school at this point. And he's like, oh, my mom's boyfriend told me to wait here. I was like, what? And this is not the complex they lived in. And he said he went to the casino. And I said, okay, are you going to school today? He's like, I don't know. I said, okay, well, I think I'm going to take you to school. Also, I don't know if that was a good decision. As I was talking to Dustin about that this morning, I was like, I don't know if I should have done that. I was just compelled. Whatever. So I took him to school. I did call his mom. And I said, hey, I saw Christopher this morning. I didn't know where your boyfriend was, but he seemed like he wanted to go to school. So I took him. I hope that's okay. She was appreciative. That was okay. And I also made a report that day. My first time ever reporting a situation to DHS, which was the Oklahoma system there, not DCFS, but it was a hard report to make, but there were enough things along the way where I just, like, this isn't okay anymore. Somebody needs to be at least checking in on this family and making sure they're getting services if needed. And so they were not removed from their home, which I was really glad about. But we just kept coming alongside those kids. And I guess it was sort of, when we look back, it was a weird sort of respite, daycare, babysitting beginning of our heart for kids who weren't being cared for the right way.
And I think I remember the school then had your number, because you're like, if he doesn't get picked up or something. So I wonder, I know that they called you once, but then maybe the mom showed up or something.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the next thing. So the next thing that happened was some people in our church that we were involved in at the time got a call. So we're in Oklahoma. They got a call from Iowa saying...
Could I interrupt? Sorry.
Yes.
So 2009, Catalyst.
Okay.
So that was 2007 with the Muldoon family. Maybe this is the engineering side of me. This will speak to the engineers. I like the timeline. So
details.
So 2009, Catalyst Conference. It's like a Christian leadership conference, and it has all the bells and whistles, and it's fun. They give out tons of free stuff, and it's inspiring. And we didn't really know what we were. Someone told us we should go. But anyway, when it's important, I think, in looking back, because it really was the first time we were exposed to the broad scale needs in the world. And even the term social justice, I bet that was one of the first times we even heard that as a concept or became familiar with it. And so we were really both exposed to the darkness of trafficking and all of the orphans in the world. And Charity Water was there. Right Love Under Arms was there. And hearing from these people who were making a difference. So it was like both it's exposure to like the depth of the darkness, and also this inspiration of these people just decided to make a difference, and they're picking one area to make a deep investment. And so it's like there was just the lady who started Kiva.org, which is a micro lending. You know, like she just started talking to her friends and family. And, you know, we got to hear from all these people. It was just really inspiring.
So then a couple years later, that family that I was talking about at our church, they got the call from Iowa, their state services, and said, hey, we have your nieces here. I know you don't know them, but you're on the list of family to contact. Would you be willing to bring home the 5 and 4-year-old into Oklahoma and probably adopt them? And I remember Mona sent out a Facebook message. I actually went back to try to find the Facebook message. I don't know where it went. But I remember her saying, should I do this? And she had sent it to a few people, and the counselor in me was like, yes, but consider these things. I mean, I didn't know really about foster care at this point. And I was just talking about like birth order and all whatever jargon I knew at the time. And they said yes. They brought home a 5 and a 4-year-old. They had a 3 and a 2-year-old of their own, and they were single income family, dad working crazy hours, no family in the area. And we decided to organize a room makeover for them. So when they brought their kids home, they could have a room that was set up. And we broke into their house while they were taking the classes to be trained. And it was great. It was wonderful. What honestly still sticks out as one of my favorite days of my life was being able to see a church rally around a family and surprise them. Ugh, it was just beautiful. And so kind of encountered them and their story. Kept going. The fall of that year, I went to a conference in Oklahoma where the foster care crisis was really being highlighted for the first time in the churches there. Went to a conference where I was talking about there were 8,046 kids in the system at that moment, and there were plenty more churches than that. And so they started this initiative called the 1-1-1 Project, that if every church would take in one child for a church, then immediately every kid would be placed. There would be no more shelters, which they had there, shelters for kids who are not necessarily there because they have any more behavior issues or any specific needs than anybody else. Just there was no one to take them. So they would stay in emergency shelters for literally 365 days. I saw them still there. And so they were really making a push, partnering state and church, which you can do in Oklahoma because it's very Bible belty, to push forward and say, hey, churches, where are you in solving not orphans? These are people, kids with families, but kids who are in crisis and need people to love them in between and need people to walk alongside these families who a lot of them are working so hard to try to reunify with their kids. And so that really tugged at my heart. That conference changed a lot for us.
And it gave us a deep picture into not just the specific family, the Elstons, but like this is a statewide, a countrywide, a worldwide issue. And so then they showed, so the stats were something that really tugged at me. So Christina referenced some of these, which this is Illinois and this is more current stats, but the stats that we were exposed to for Oklahoma were very similar to this, that the number of kids in foster care in Illinois, 16,000 kids aging out annually of foster care where they're not reunified, they're not adopted, they just age out of the system and are kind of off on their own, 984. Children waiting for adoption, almost 3,000. And the number of churches in Illinois, at least if their very specific estimate, is 13,997. So just that comparison, and we still kind of are inspired of that 1-1-1 project, that if every church had one family that would take one kid, it would change the system drastically. It would just eliminate foster care as we know it, or at least completely revolutionize it. And for every kid that is given a loving, safe home, they are then getting all their needs met, so then they don't have to get their needs met through the structures and the services, which then alleviates the system for the other kids. You know, it's just, it can have a multiplication effect. But then there were a lot of other stats that I were inspiring and really eye-opening. So here's some of them. Half of the kids in foster care end up dropping out of high school. That 7/8 of them drop out of college just because of lack of funding or lack of support. Half of them report illegal drug usage. Half of the females who have been in foster care end up having a baby within a year and a half of leaving foster care. So that would probably be who age out of this, who are 18 older. 1 out of 4 experience homelessness within 2 years after aging out. and half are able to be reunified with their birth parents, but the other half not need another solution. So those stats really made us have a, it compelled us to want to come alongside the Elstons as here's this family that we know, and maybe we can't change the system or we can't affect every family in Oklahoma, but we have this family in our church that we can come alongside. And so we really just, I don't know, it was just like, we just like, we're gonna be there for them. And so we did things like, they were wanted to be part of a small group, but four kids who were six and under, they couldn't find anyone to babysit their kids. And so we were like, hey, we'll watch your kids. And so we became their weekly babysitters, which that really developed a bond with the family and the parents. And a lot of times they would just come, you know, come back after small group and want to chat with us. And it just evolved into like, we became like an aunt and uncle type figure to the kids. They would bring us little notes from school or little projects. There was a time where we hosted Haley's birthday party because the house we were renting was bigger than the house they were renting. And I think we went over for Halloween and, oh, I remember my first iPhone, my first smartphone, I took a picture of us and the kids painting pumpkins for Halloween. And so it was like every time that I opened like the pictures file on my computer, it was image 001. You know how it starts like that on iPhone? So it was like, see, I saw them every time I went to my pictures on my computer. I think Mona was like, Nathan, the husband, he would work like 60 hours a week. It was a crazy schedule. And so she would call me like sometimes like, hey, I want to do this thing, or they would want to build bunk beds, and so I went over and helped them build bunk beds or paint it, or like she wanted to surprise Nathan, Mona, and hang like his bass guitar on the wall for like a surprise, but she couldn't do it, and it was like trying to accomplish anything with four kids in the house is very difficult. So I went over and like put some screws in the wall, and it was just like all these little things. It was just like, okay, yeah, we can do that. Okay, yeah, we can do that. And it was like before we knew it, we were just like part of their family. And so it was, I don't know, it was really hard for us to leave. But that's part of the journey too. When we left, Haley, one of the kids that in the family, she said she was really sad that we were leaving, and we went over there and kind of had a special goodbye time, and she said, are we going to see you guys in heaven? And like we will come back. It's not like we're never going to see you again. And we're like, and I think Mona's like, yeah, of course you'll see him in heaven. And Haley goes, can we go to heaven right now? And it's just,
for them, I mean, we were the next set of caring adults that they had that was stable for them. So that was a really big deal. And it was really hard to leave. And it was the right thing to do. And good goodbyes, when you're working with kids who've had so many goodbyes that have not been planned, it is so important to do really good goodbyes. And see you later if you can. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there was one moment where they didn't know if they'd be able to adopt. They started feeling really overwhelmed. I mean, that's just a lot to take on. They were struggling financially. And as much as we were doing, like, we weren't their family. And so there was one night where we went over to a friend's house who was in their small group. And they happened to share with us, Nathan and Mona don't know if they're going to be able to stay with them. Like, they may have to have them return back to Iowa and find another home. And my stomach just dropped, like, oh my gosh, that cannot happen. And Dustin and I didn't really talk while we were there, but on the way home, we had a conversation, or a short conversation.
Yeah, so I remember where we were driving from our friend's house to ours, and we were like, what's going to happen if they say it's too much to handle? Because they were feeling overwhelmed. And we're like, we'll take them. They're not going back. And that was the first time I remember us vocalizing, like, we will welcome kids into our home. And so it just made sense. It was like, no, And then we were like, isn't that going to be awkward? We still go to church with them. And, you know, are they going to feel weird? But
I go into planning mode. Okay, so what do we do? Like, how do we have to? Yeah. But we didn't have to go there because they pulled through. You know, they got more support. They pulled through and they adopted them on National Adoption Day the year following when they came. And they're doing great. And they've worked through a lot. And behavior's continued for a long time. And there's ongoing services that they need. But, man, it's a beautiful family. And we are just lucky to be a part of it and to help it shape what. It shaped so much of what we could see for ourselves for the long term. So we knew we were going to say yes at some point. We came to Peoria in 2013 in the summer, and one of those reasons for moving here is not just because we have a wonderful church here, but it's because we wanted to be closer to family. We intentionally thought through, does this make sense to do far away from a caring support system? As we, I know we have best friends out here, they feel like family, but we just really knew we were going to need people. And so we moved back to Illinois. And here we are. So it wasn't my favorite decision.
Did you see that face? Did you see the face? Her faces say everything.
Oh, the weather. It's really just the weather. I love all of you, but yeah.
Yeah, so we were fortunate to have the time to process that decision. And at some point, maybe it was a year, I would say a year before we moved, we were like, we are definitely going to foster at some point. And that's how we want to start our family.
Yeah, I want to share that openly too. Sorry to interrupt you. But like, yeah. A lot of people wonder, and it's always strange to ask, and people feel weird. Like, was it a fertility thing? Not at all for us. We don't know if we would have been able to have kids, and we've always prevented so that we could do it this way. This was just our choice, and this is just the way we wanted to do it. So.
And so it was like, okay, what steps do we need to make to set ourselves up for success? And so both of our parents are still married and live around, you know, Decatur, Bloomington area. So we're like, okay, Peoria would be the northernmost. And of course, Ryan's here. And so we're really glad that we made that choice, because I think it really did give us an extra boost in this season.
Okay, so we moved to an apartment. We took classes while we were there. We waited till we got a house. And then I should be clear on that. There are classes you take to become a foster parent. They're called Pride classes in Illinois. They're 9 weeks long, or if you do it on Saturdays and like to get stuff done super efficiently like I do, you do it in four and a half weeks, you know. So we did that, sat through those trainings. Man, they were really good trainings. I have background in this kind of stuff. Dustin worked with a kid with special needs for 6 years, was his Manny. And so we felt prepared, but man, those classes are really good. The videos are terrible. Illinois budget, but the everything else is really good. And so we're so glad we took those classes, got licensed in fall of 2014. And the day we were supposed to have our home visit, the licensure worker comes, make sure you have smoke detectors, does a variety of things to make sure kids are going to be safe in your home. Before she came, she called and said, we have a placement for you. And I said, you haven't been here. That's terrifying. And what is the placement? And she said, it's three kids. And we said, we only wanted to do two. And so let me explain that a little bit for those of you who've wondered, like, do they just call you with any random number at any time of the day? Kind of. Because that's their job, is to push, because they need to find good homes for kids. And so the really good part of it is you take time when you're signing up to think through, what are you capable of doing? What is your best contribution? Are you able to handle specific medical needs? Do you have a background in that? Then maybe you could say yes to a kiddo who has that in front of them. Are you good with behaviors that could be needing therapy? And which we were okay with that kind of stuff. So we said yes on some of that. And then how many? And what kind of trauma are you willing to take that they've gone through in the past? It feels very weird, but at the same time, it gave us the space to be prayerful and intentional about not just what were we capable of, but how far past that would God allow us to have his grace to serve this way. Because if we were all just going to say yes to what we're capable of, then I think we would all just say no to parenting in general. Like, it's difficult. So I think we gave ourselves space so that I wasn't talked into something that was beyond our capacity, but yet, or beyond what God could do with us. I'm not saying that we couldn't have done more, but we felt like it wasn't the right thing. So we said no that day. We said no. I said no. They always called me. I'm good at decisions on the spot. We said no 4 times. And actually to our girls once, we said no. Because their situation, without getting too much into it, they have a sibling. And so the original call was for them to be together. And we're like, we cannot go from 0 to 3 children. Whoa. So we said no. And then they called back a week later and they said the family who has them, they were in a good foster family at the time. They said the family who has them wants to keep the sibling. Would you be willing to take the other two? And I kind of said, no, I don't want to split them. Like, no way. And they said, they're going to be split anyway, and we don't want to have to split the girls if you're willing. And I thought, okay, I guess we'll do that. We weren't picturing a situation where we would have an ongoing relationship with siblings, which has been a very interesting thing to navigate. It's not easy, but it's so crucial, and it's mandated by law that they see their sibling. And so we said yes, and it was our first yes, and we are now in the process of adopting, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll be able to get there. So it was a lot of no's, but we were waiting for the right yes for us. And had we said yes to any of those other placements, we know these would not be our daughters. And it's a super weird thing to think about, because our home would have been filled with that child for some period of time. Anyway, I don't believe that everything is like orchestrated perfectly by God, but I really felt his hand in the decision making, and I think that's essential. So,
well, and we also, I think there was one or two times that we said no to one, because we felt like our best contribution would be to say yes to two, because some families can only say yes to one. So I think there was at least one call where we were like, okay, tell them to call around, and if you can't find any other families, circle back around us. And then they never called again. So that was good. But yeah. So in part of the process for us that has allowed us to say yes and allowed us to observe so many other people saying yes to their own contribution and their own challenges is the calling that undergirds it. So there's a calling. I think you're going to take the first pass at.
Yeah, we're kind of thinking through like the principles that continue to develop in our marriage and in our family, and like what we want our life to be about. And a lot of that has been shaped through this process. And so one of those things was basically, to whom much is given, much is required. And there's a scripture in Luke where it talks about the idea of like, you've been given the stuff in order to do something with it. And it's very compelling to me. It's not just need. It's not just that there is definitely a biblical mandate to care for people and who are marginalized and in distress, but that particularly me, I was given a whole lot. And how that works, I don't know. But man, I know that once I was given it, there is something I have to do with it out of gratitude and out of responsibility and not an obligation. Like, it's not an obligation to me. It's such an honor. Still hard, but we continually try to think through that in our lives. What have we been given and what do we do with it? How do we steward that? Our resources, our time, our family.
And we really feel like God continues to give us his grace and his strength and everything. We would not have survived in the last couple of years without him. Another thing of in our attempt to follow him is to see where is he going. And I think that's been a compass for us along, that it's relational. It's relational investment, that he is with us. God is Emmanuel, the God with us, that Jesus was with people, and with people that other people were like, hey, why are you with those people? They're not worth the time. And Jesus is like, yes, they are. I will leave the 99 to go to the one. And I will be with the people that you count as worthless, the marginalized people, because they deserve it. And so I think that's been inspirational for us, that's the way of Jesus. And so if we're following his way, how can we not go there? And then you see even the early disciples, and how that through Jesus's words and actions and they lived with him, and then how some of those apostles who wrote some of the scriptures in the New Testament, that James talks about true religion is caring for the widows and the orphans, or in Acts that they were caring for the needy and they were with people and they were living their lives sacrificially and generously with the people around them. And that's been an anchor point that we're like, we don't want to do this, but yet we do.
So, and there's a constant reassessing. I think, now that we are on the road to adoption with our beautiful girls, like, will we in the future say yes again to opening our home? I don't know. The factors are different this time, right? Now we have kids who've been through a lot more than they would have been through if they were born to us. And so that's something to consider. But we're going to continually ask and not just be comfortable with saying we did it, we did this thing, and now we're done. And I think that's really important in all areas of life. And so I'm holding us to that right now in front of people that we will reassess when it doesn't feel so hard. And discipleship requires death, right? Like, we want to make it easy sometimes, but following Jesus, he talks about dying to yourself. And so, I don't know, man, that's hard. So
this is, you know, some of our personal inspiration, but it's also, we believe it's some of these things our church is called to, that's the invitation is, it goes in different ways, and there might be different outcomes to some of those callings and some of those, the ways of following Jesus, but that we also believe that our church is uniquely positioned to make an impact specifically in foster care in our city. And so we have this foster care initiative, and so we really believe our church has a collective calling to come together and to be with the kids in Peoria and the surrounding area. And that honestly, that we're better together, that we know we have not made it alone in this process. And so how much more beautiful would it be if we as a church can come together and use our individual gifts and resources and capacities to help in different ways, little and big, and that we believe that there's a synergy and a collective force for good that we can make instead of our individual detached contributions.
I think part of the uniqueness of Imago and what drives a lot of people here is often that we are very open, right? And maybe it's first, if you come on a Sunday morning, you hear the generous orthodoxy with which we teach, that we are welcoming. I mean, our shirts, what do they say again? Oh yeah, all are welcome. And I hope we live that. And I hope that we're not just open in the way we think about things, but that those thoughts lead to action and that we're open in the way we live our lives. And that's harder, right? It's easy to be open a theory like in your head and just say like, yeah, we believe that's a good thing. But it's harder to open up your lives to something important. And so I believe that we have that in this room though, that people wouldn't be here. You guys wouldn't be here unless you believed that there's something about church in a local body, whether or not we have issues with organized religion. I hope that you're here this morning for some reason because you believe that the collective nature of being Christ followers matters. And I believe that about our particular church. And these kids are close to God's heart. There's a lot of scripture about it. You know, the interesting thing is that we already do a lot of good stuff in our city. We've been doing the Breakfast Club that happened really organically from the beginning of this church to care for people who are without homes. And when I sit down and talk to people on Sunday mornings and I have brought up our journey, I'm very as open as I can be. People are so interested and I just love it. Anyway, they ask great questions. But I sit down and I start talking about foster care and I kid you not, I think if I could do statistics just based on like noticing things, 50% of the time, or 50% of the people at the tables I sit at have been involved in foster care in one way or the other. Maybe they grew up and went to a foster home for a little while, or maybe they were adopted through foster care, or maybe their kids have now been placed into foster care and they're working really hard to get them back, or maybe rights have been terminated and they're hoping that someday to be able to regain some kind of relationship when their kids are older. There's just a lot of people who've been touched, and so the connection between what we're already doing and this made a lot of sense for me, and I hope for our church.
And it really, even some of those stats I read earlier, you can see some of the relationship between foster care and when someone doesn't have a support system or a healthy home, or they were moved from place to place. I mean, and they don't know. I mean, just think of how traumatic that is. And so it leads, if they can never return to that, or even sometimes just if it's a year, you know, some of those traumas can carry with them and lead to drug use or lead to dropping out of college or whatever. And so part of the reason that we are really excited about our church taking steps forward in the foster care initiative is because it's not just one issue that we're taking care of. By investing in foster care, we're helping to prevent future homelessness on some level. We're helping to prevent incarceration. We're hoping to prevent some poverty, some trafficking, and any other host of issues. There's a double-sided arrow because the more you decrease poverty, then it would help alleviate some foster care as well. But it's like they're so interconnected And it's just, that's where God's light needs to shine, because there's brokenness. And I find that particularly inspiring, that it's not just intervention and doing justice for these people right now, but it's the prevention of future injustices.
And there's just, on a practical level, there's just so many ways to engage the system other than opening your home and becoming a foster parent. And I hope we're starting to highlight those here throughout the year about giving at Christmas time, buying presents for families, doing the diaper drive, uniforms. Mentoring is something we're looking toward in the future, that Family Corps is looking for people who are willing to just invest one day a week and come alongside maybe a teenager who's just looking for another caring adult who would not be disrupted as if they were to move from one home to the next. That mentor could stay with them. There are a myriad of ways that Family Corps is willing to work with us, and I am super excited about it. And at the same time, one of the ways we want to continue to serve them is by serving the people who work in this day in and day out, who are in the trenches, who are underpaid, and who, when they burn out, that means that another person has to come over and take over their case, and now it's a new person in those kids' lives who's been walking with them. Man, it's just another disruption, right? It's just another goodbye for those kids. And so we're trying to prevent that. We're trying to honor these workers who are devoting their lives to something that's super important. And so I wanted to share with you guys the video that was put together by Justin from a couple weeks ago when we went and we got to serve the people who work at Family Corps. It was a wonderful day. They were so appreciative. I could not even believe it. There were seven of us there, and they were just like, thank you. Oh, eight, sorry. And thank you. No one's ever done this for us before. And we just served Qdoba. And thank you for your donations. I want to be clear on how our budget works as best I can. Every dollar you give here, some of it goes to stuff like this. There's a percentage of each dollar that goes to outreach outside of our church. So thank you for giving consistently. And thank you for specific people who gave gift cards and prizes and stuff for raffles. They were thrilled by gift cards that I could kind of forgot how much they were worth. So it was like, a gift card to Starbucks, it will buy you something, you know, and they don't care. Like, they were just so excited. And so thank you. Let's watch the video so those of you who couldn't be there can just see what it was like. It matters, and we have a lot going on around here that so many people participate in behind the scenes, and then you don't get to see what happens. And so I hope that little tidbit into it helps you know that what you do here matters. So before we close, I want to address something that's often a sticking point for people when it comes to becoming a foster family. And it's this this quote right here. I can't because it would be too hard for me when the kids leave. And I want to first say that I don't think everyone is called to be foster parents. We didn't set out this morning to convince everyone here to call Family Corps and sign up for the next set of classes. But I do believe that there are more of us in this room who could do that, that there are individuals, which you can be single and do this, and couples who have thought about this a couple of times or 100 times, and yet the idea of loving kids and then watching them leave can hold you back. And I want to say that, first of all, it's okay to grieve. We need people who love deeply enough that that question pops into their mind, because we need people who will love these kids and will hurt when they go, because we hope they go back, right? Don't we want to see families held together? So we need people who have that come into their mind. It's hard, and I haven't had to say goodbye, so I can't speak from that experience, but I've talked with other families who have. And I know what it would have been like for me when things in the court system were taking forever, and I was super nervous that is how things were going to end. And I knew what I thought was best for our girls. And I thought, if this gets disrupted, what are we going to do? But I also thought that there was the hours spent tucking them in and answering all of their questions and taking them to school and listening to their stories and wiping their tears and being their mom and their dad. Those hours would not have been wasted. And I can grieve if I need to. Like, God is with us in that. Pursuing pain to help alleviate it in others is part of what it means to love. Like, just let that sink in. Like, sometimes you have to pursue it because we have to take something on in order for other people to have what they need and to have a fair chance at life. And now I'm not afraid to grieve. I'm really more afraid of what will happen to these kids if no one rises up to take them. That if the best people who are connected to Jesus in some way and trying to live like him, I'm afraid that if we don't step in, that things will get worse. And it's worth it. It's worth it. So what do we do? Well, I want to encourage everybody in this room to keep saying your next yes and our collective yes, next yes, to the next right thing. Whatever is in front of you, ask the Holy Spirit to continue to guide you in those things, to illuminate your path, maybe just one step at a time, because it can kind of be scary if you see the whole thing. If when we had said yes to taking some kids home from daycare the one day, would have said, well, this is the first step to bringing two girls home into your home. You know, 6 years later, we would have been like, whoa, hold on a second. We don't know if we want kids, for real. So, you know, one step at a time. I look back at our story and I think about how it actually didn't really start with us. It really started with Mona, the mom who we got to come alongside when she adopted her nieces, with her story, when her parents were tragically killed in a car accident when she was young. She and her two brothers were adopted by their pastor in their church. So when they got that call, I think she knew deep down she would never say no. Like, she had seen what it was like to be without a family and had been taken in and loved. And so that first yes from them led to so much. The Elstons, Mona and Nathan, saying yes led to us saying yes. That leads to our church saying yes. And I'm hopeful that this is the beginning of not just something cool for our church to be united around. I'm hopeful that our church can lead the way in our city, in this arena. And that's big, but that's really what I'm hoping. That we'll get involved where there is brokenness and hurt and pain and difficulty. We'll attempt to live lives of faithfulness to the calling that Jesus has placed on our lives. I know there are other passions in this room for reconciliation racially, for interfaith connections and dialogue and movement and love, and seeing an end to modern-day slavery and finding ways to end homelessness in this city. And this is just our next right thing and our collective next right thing, and I'm praying that we can lean into it together, that we'll use our strengths to really change the trajectory of so many lives forever. May His Spirit lead us.